I've always been the type to go all in. When I get into something, whether it's fitness, food, or just following every twist and turn of the season, I want to explore every angle. That's why Prime is such a game changer. It's not just fast delivery, though getting a new cookbook or resistance bands the next day definitely helps. It's also the deep dives on Prime Video, the playlists that match my mood on Amazon Music, and the way all of it comes together to keep me going. What I've learnt is this: Prime isn't just a service, it's a hub, a place where my interests, old and new, can live and grow. From race day rituals to everyday obsessions, Prime helps me get more out of whatever I'm into, and even shows me what's next. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into. amazon.com/prime.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com.
It was clear that there was somebody else waiting in the wings, and it was only a matter of time, right? I mean, it was going to happen.
This time he's going into the car, knowing he has to do a certain level of performance to prove to the team he deserves to keep that seat.
How do you find another one like Ollie, who is going to work really well and really closely with Flavio? Not an easy one.
There was a lot of radio chat in Miami. Rob, maybe you're the guy to comment on this, given your radio chat, and I'm thinking of Hockenheim 2010.
Oh my God, why are you bringing that up? Williams need to step up in all areas to be able to accommodate the driver of his stature. But it's good to see that they're not going to be happy with mediocre performances anymore.
If we think Max is still in the title fight, does that mean George Russell is a title contender as well?
I mean, mathematically, yes.
Would you re-sign George Russell if Max Verstappen is available?
Oh, that's a very, very tough question.
Welcome everyone to F1 Nation's preview of this weekend's Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix, the start of the European leg of the season and our second triple header of the year. Oscar Piastri leads the championship by 16 points, having won 4 of the 6 races to date. Can he win at Imola for the first time? Or will Lando Norris steal back the momentum? Or will Imola maestro Max Verstappen take his 4th consecutive win at the track? There's lots to discuss, and joining me, Tom Clarkson, is F1 correspondent and presenter Lawrence Barreto and former Jordan Ferrari and Williams engineer Rob Smedley. Guys, great to have you both on the show. How are you, Lawrence?
I'm really good, Tom. Still a bit jet-lagged from Miami, but I'm excited that we've got a proper championship fight on our hands, and always exciting to have a bit of news to report on between races with that Alpine saga.
Well, look, we'll come on to that. Now, Rob, great to have you on the show again. How's life?
Very well, thank you, guys. Yes, thank you for having me. Busy, just always busy, but good to talk to you guys.
Well, look, let's crack straight on with what Lawrence has just referred to. Reserve driver at Alpine, Franco Colapinto, is replacing Jack Doohan. And Lawrence, why has Alpine demoted Jack just 6 races into the season?
That's a big question that hopefully we're going to spend the next 10, 15, 20 minutes talking about, Tom. But the short version is, as soon as they brought Franco on board as a reserve driver in January, they came to this agreement with Williams that they could effectively loan him for a period of time. It was clear that the only reason James Fowles let him go was because he felt that Alpine and Franco's team felt that Alpine offered him the best chance to get a race seat. So I think there was always a target on Jack's back as soon as that deal was done. Alpine have obviously gone along and evaluated Jack's performance. I think it was always their intention to put Franco in the car mid-season. It was just a question of when. And Jack obviously hasn't scored points at all this year. He only out-qualified Pierre once, and that was last time out in Miami. And Franco has been banging on the door, itching to get in. And they've just decided to do that just ahead of a European stretcher races, which Franco's obviously got some experience on those three tracks coming up.
I mean, it's ironic, isn't it, that Jack out-qualified Pierre Gasly last time out. I guess, Rob, he's going to feel pretty hard done by. He thinks he was getting better and better.
Yeah, and I think to be honest, he should feel, you know, hard done by as well. You know, that's not to say that the decision is completely wrong, but like any of us, if you were given just six attempts to do a very hard job right and do it better than, you know, your more experienced colleagues, whatever that job is, you probably feel hard done by when you weren't able to do that. And I think that, you know, if you look at some of the rookies that we've got coming in this year, we've got some exceptional rookies, in fact. The most exceptional of them is sat in the Mercedes against George Russell. You'd argue that George and Pierre have a similar amount of experience in Formula One. You know, George has probably been in a top team for slightly longer, both very, very accomplished and qualified drivers. You know, Kimi has certainly done well against George, but has at times looked like the rookie he is. But Mercedes have taken a completely different viewpoint on that. This is a learning year. They keep telling him it's a learning year. He's in a top team. He's against a very accomplished driver, like we've just said. I don't think Jack Doohan got a similar amount of grace. I think from the get-go, from even before he got in the car in any kind of official capacity, it was clear that there was somebody else waiting in the wings. And it was only a matter of time, right? I mean, it was going to happen. And I think that's probably weighed quite heavily on him. That would weigh quite heavily on any of us, right? You know, these are elite sports people, but they're also at the same time young people trying to find their way in life to a certain extent. You put that amount of pressure on somebody in a pressure cooker environment like Formula One, they're not going to do well. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, but officially at least, Colapinto's only getting the next five races, or do you think that's just PR in overdrive and actually he's in for the rest of the year? What do we know, Lawrence?
I think it gives them all the options, doesn't it? I think by giving him five races, if he doesn't do a job that they consider good enough, then they could potentially swap Jack in. They could give poor Aaron a go if that's what they want to do. But if obviously if he does a good job, they can say, well, we've compared his run or whatever the test that they do in those five races, and we've compared it to what Jack did in the six this year, plus the obviously Abu Dhabi at the end of last year. And then they can come up publicly and say, this is where we're at. I think it probably would have been tougher on Jack to say we're going to give Colapinto the rest of the season in the way that Red Bull did with Yuki after they swapped him in for Liam. I think that would have been tougher on Jack. So at least this maybe gives Jack a little bit more time to kind of understand where he's at and maybe still prove internally that he's got what it takes. And I think they'll be interested to see how he copes with it and whether or not he still does the job that they need him to do, which is obviously get in the simulator and do all the work that he needs to do to help Colapinto now at race weekends coming up.
Let's look at Colapinto now. Cast our minds back to the middle of last year. He comes in for Monza to replace Logan Sargeant at Williams. And then he gets that, I think, what was it, an eighth place in Baku. And the whole Formula One paddock went mad for Franco Colapinto. And, you know, a few weeks later, Christian Horner was seen in the Williams motorhome trying to do a deal. And then suddenly the accidents started to come, didn't they, later in the year. I feel he's got unfinished business. And funnily enough, Rob, he could do with an experienced race engineer like yourself, just guiding him through these next moments, couldn't he?
Yeah, that is what I think rookies benefit from more than anything, is having people close to them in their inner circle, if you like. And one of those key figures is the race engineer, who absolutely has their back. Okay, that's part and parcel of being a race engineer with your driver, but can also guide them through the bits that they don't know. Because you can't blame a rookie for not knowing what they don't know, right? It's just part of life. So I think that having an experienced race engineer, having an experienced team around them is going to be absolute paramount, is of paramount importance to be able to get this right.
I mean, cast your mind back to 2009, Rob. You know, Felipe has that terrible accident in Hungary, and then suddenly you found yourself working with, I think first it was Luca Badoa, wasn't it? The Ferrari test driver who was promoted up, and then Giancarlo Fisichella then makes the jump from Force India. But with Badoa in particular, how difficult was it to guide him through those couple of races you did together?
That was quite tumultuous, to be honest, for all of us. And I think it was kind of throwing Luca in the deep end. I mean, don't forget, he wasn't a rookie. He had race experience, but the race experience had come from many, many years before in the Minardi. And I think overall, we were putting him in, and this is what happens in a top team at least, you're putting somebody under an extra level of pressure because they're going into a top team, right? So he's not a rookie going into a midfield team. This is a rookie going into a top team. Then you've got an extra layer of pressure because it's Ferrari, right? So even that you've got in Formula One in terms of pressure and passion and expectation, you've got Ferrari and then you've got everybody else. And then layer on top of that in 2009 was that car was not very good. And I think that when we put the original Kimi, the Finnish one, and Felipe from Brazil, they were actually managing to score lots of points with that car. You know, we had no chance of wins. We were podiums every now and again, but we were managing to score lots of points. For me, that showed how good those two drivers were when we put two other drivers in the car. Giancarlo Fisichella, for example, had almost won the Belgian Grand Prix the weekend before he came to Ferrari after we replaced Luca. And in fact, he couldn't qualify in the top 10. And I think what that shows you is what the value of experienced drivers can bring against a rookie. You know, it completely changes the dynamic. It can completely change like how the team has to work because the team is now having to kind of tidy up the mistakes or even be proactively thinking about what mistakes the rookie's going to make and how you can, you know, mitigate for them. Whereas with an experienced driver, you're really concentrating 100%. You're focusing 100% on the performance. And that's why the performance is not always there between the rookie and the experienced driver. So yeah, any kind of injection of experience, injection of like mitigation for the mistakes that are going to happen, that's going to be absolutely key to getting Franco up to speed in these races.
I think it will benefit him to have three races on the bounce, particularly at tracks that he knows pretty well, Imola, Monza, Barcelona.
Actually, he's gone well at Imola, hasn't he? I think he won in F2 and in F3, I think.
And he did a test there, I think, in old machinery in Alpine earlier this year as well. Frankly, he'll have been itching to get in the car from the minute he signed that contract, and I think he would take any opportunity he's going to get. I think what's interesting about this chance relative to his Williams one is he went into that car knowing he had 9 races that, and then there wasn't going to be a seat at the end of it. So almost the pressure is off, right? You just do what you can. You do the best. You try and sell yourself in the best way. Whereas this time he's going into the car knowing he has to do a certain level of performance to prove to the team that he deserves to keep that seat. Now, there are obviously other factors involved beyond the performance. There's that huge fan base and the engagement Alpine will get through the Argentinian fans. They're even more mobilised than the Mexican fans were with Checo. And there's obviously the massive commercial back-end that he brings to the team that we've already seen with the stickers on the car that will only increase when he's a race seat. So I think the difficulty for Jack is it's not just about the performance that Franco is going to deliver over these few races that he gets the opportunity. It's all the other factors that Jack just can't compete against. He can't bring that loyal fan base. He can't bring that amount of financial firepower. So actually bringing it back again, I think that probably will help Franco settle in a bit quicker. I think he'll back himself, frankly, to do the job. You talked about him. I think he got points in 2 of the first 4 races for Williams when he started. I think he'll back himself to do that kind of thing because that car at the minute is kind of on the fringes of being able to fight for points if they get the setup right from the start of the weekend in obviously what's a very tight midfield.
Loz, to have a long-term future there, does he have to beat Pierre Gasly?
No, I don't think so. Which I know might sound strange, but I think to have a long-term future there, I think he's just got to score and he's got to be up there with Pierre because ultimately they just want two cars scoring in what they're describing as this transitional year before they move to the Mercedes power units next year. And I think that with that back in, so long as he can deliver some peak performances like we've already seen he's possible, they'll probably outweigh the bad weekends where, like in Brazil last year, he crashed twice, and Vegas he crashed and ramps up the damage bill. I think it probably will all work out well, as long as he has enough of those peak weekends.
This episode is sponsored by Indeed. You've just realised that your business needed to hire someone yesterday. And when the clock is ticking and the pressure is mounting, speed is of the essence. And that's where Indeed steps in. Join the 3.5 million employers worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Indeed's sponsored jobs ensure your listing doesn't get buried among countless others. Instead, it rises to the top of search results, reaching the most relevant candidates first. That kind of visibility can make all the difference. In fact, data from Indeed shows that sponsored jobs posted directly on the platform receive 45% more applications compared to non-sponsored listings. There are no subscriptions, no long-term contracts. You just pay for results. And what I really like about Indeed is how it streamlines the whole hiring process. It's fast, efficient, and helps you connect with quality candidates without the stress. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/nation. Just go to Indeed.com/nation right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/nation. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed is all you need.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda Racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda Racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at Honda.com.
Now, the other big change at Alpine is that team principal Oliver Oakes has resigned with immediate effect. Executive advisor Flavio Briatore will cover his duties for the foreseeable future. Rob, you've worked with many team principals. If you were looking for a new one at Alpine, what qualities would you look for in that person?
Here you've got to get somebody who is a good foil and works really well with Flavio as well, right? Because if you haven't got that really strong relationship and you're not able to build that relationship and work together, and you know there's not that compromise between the two parties, and there has to be, then it's not going to work, right? Because if you've got like two alphas who are trying to do exactly the same thing, it simply just won't work. It will just have a short shelf life and all fail, and the team will end up in a worse situation. So I think that's the key one here. Somebody who is prepared to work in the way that Flavio is molding this team. And it's very funny, right, that Flavio's becoming de facto CEO of the team, right? Or he is the de facto CEO of the team. So then how do you find another one like Ollie, who was able, you know, had all of that experience, perhaps, you know, not in Formula One to start off with, but he'd done it at the highest level in other areas of the sport. How do you find another one like that, who's got the F1 experience, who's got the business acumen, who knows what it takes to turn the team around, but somebody who also is going to work like really well and really closely with Flavio? Not an easy one.
So is it someone who has previous team principal experience? You know, there are a few of those knocking around. I mean, Gunter Steiner, for example. I mean, even guys that have been at Alpine before, like Otmar Szafnauer, he's hungry to get back in. Or do you go for a Mike Crack type figure who, you know, he was demoted from team principal of Aston Martin to chief trackside operations, I think he is now. An engineer, is he the type of person maybe?
There's a trend now of taking, you know, very senior engineers and making them team principal. And I think it's very dependent on the team, because each team has a different version of a team principal. So there's a Toto Wolff version of a team principal who is the CEO and a shareholder and runs everything, right? Makes all the decisions, or arbitrates all the decisions, let's say, is a better way of putting it. Also has a view on long-term strategy, deals with the board and all the rest of it. Then you've got other versions of team principal. You know, if that's one end of the scale, there's another end, which is kind of somebody who is a chief operations engineer or something like that. It was very much just focused on the race team. I think the Alpine job, you know, Ollie's job was quite different. That was probably something in the middle. So it can't just be purely an engineer. It's got to be somebody who has a bit of like business and political acumen in the arena of Formula One. Whether or not you take somebody who's done it before, you know, that's one way of looking at it. Or you take somebody who hasn't done team principal before, but, you know, has all of those values and attributes that we've just talked about. Don't know. I mean, they will probably have, you know, a list of people that they are talking to or want to talk to at least. And it just depends on whether or not they can find the right fit, you know, on both sides of the fence for the guy that they're, you know, the person that they're talking to and from their own point of view.
When you threw out Mike Crack's name, I thought that could be a great solution, just because I think he's potentially a bit disappointed with the way things have gone at Aston since he's been effectively demoted. I think he likes being out of the limelight, but I think he probably could like this hybrid role where he could get on with the day-to-day business of running a team, but let Flavio take the limelight and do the bigger decisions and maybe take the glory almost. I think he probably would like that. I wondered whether someone like an Alain Permain might be interested in it, because obviously he knows a lot of people at that team. It hurt him, obviously, when he left that operation, and it means a lot to him. So I wondered whether that could be an option. I think, to Rob's point, I think finding the person in this very, very niche role is going to be difficult. And I think that's why Ollie and Flavio work so well together. And I remember when Flavio first announced the news, he said it was very clear quite quickly that Ollie was the one, just because of the way that they dovetailed. But maybe there was this acceptance very early on from Ollie that I know where my lane is and I know where Flavio's lane is. And they just did a very good job of just staying in those respective lanes. And I think Ollie did a very good job, from people I talked to at the team, very quickly of just being an Enstone every day, making sure that he was going around, kind of explaining to people that he was there, his door was open, always open. I think people kind of got behind him very quickly, and that is quite an impressive character trait. I think he loved the job. He'd always wanted to be a team principal in Formula One, and so he had this opportunity, and I think he threw everything at it. I think there probably would have been a disappointment that it wasn't a full team principal in the sense that he had overall control, but I think he would have relish the opportunity to maybe put himself in the shop window and look forward. So I think to find someone to fit this role is going to be really difficult. I think you mentioned Günther Steiner. I kind of feel like he's had the best time of his life at Haas, where he had utter control. So I think he probably would struggle to fit into that role unless he's got bored of doing all his media duties and he wants to just get back in. I think, I'm not sure that that role fits it. But and I'm not sure that Otmar can ever go back after what happened and the way that he left. So it is a difficult one. But and they could also promote from within, I guess. They've just taken on Dave Greenwood, haven't they, as racing director. They could maybe split the responsibilities a little bit differently. I think McLaren have done a good job of showing you can run a team in a very different way to the very normal, like, team boss runs everything. Zach and Andrea have separate roles than their technical department is structured in this pillar format. Like, there's lots of ways you can run a team, and I guess Flavio has got to decide firstly how much he wants to get involved, which will probably be 20%, 30% in terms of actually running the team, and then see who he trusts within the team already and who he can convince to come over.
I also think the power will migrate towards the new person in time. Flavio's in his mid-70s, right? And I think his job, as far as Luca de Meo is concerned, is to set the team on the right path. And I think once he's done that, if the new team principal comes in and learns from Flavio how Renault want it done, then I think that person will get more power in due course.
I would agree with that. You've got to be very careful, especially in something as big as a team principal role, not to be too greedy with it. And I think actually the best way that this can work is that you do actually have Flavio there dealing with the board of Renault. You know, he's got the direct line to Luca Di Meo. He is perhaps, you know, plotting the longer term strategy of the team and stuff like that. You know, this is actually, if you can come in and take that a slightly, I don't want to say smaller role, because it's still a huge role, right? But if you can take that and then not be too greedy, like not want everything like straight away, it will come to you anyway. I mean, I always find personally that responsibility, power, if you want to call it that, that will come to you anyway, right? If you just do a good job. I think people are too eager to have, you know, a piece of paper that says, I've got all the power. And then what you do with that is like they sometimes don't use it in the right way, or quite often don't use it in the right way. I think it's better to do actually what Ollie was doing, which is to come in, do a good job, make himself known and make himself valuable to the literally hundreds of men and women at Enstone. And with that comes respect and eventually power. You know, you get that. It was those executive decision-making powers in time, but earn them as well. You know, don't come in and expect that you should have everything on a plate on day one.
Now, Ferrari. They finished 14 points behind world champions McLaren at the end of 2024. And after only six races this year, they're 152 points adrift in fourth place. And they finished 57 seconds behind race winner Oscar Piastri in Miami. A lot was made of their team orders and team radio in that race, but lack of pace and performance is clearly the biggest issue. Lewis Hamilton in the pre-race press conference was pretty monosyllabic. He's clearly fed up with being asked to explain the lack of performance. So, will their fortunes change in their first home race of the season at Imola? I mean, Rob, engineering head on, why do you think Ferrari are struggling for performance this year?
The car's not that easy to drive. It certainly doesn't suit, I think, Lewis's driving style. I think Charles can get a bit more on top of it over a single time lap. When you're really putting the car on the edge and you need a really solid, you know, high speed rear, like so when you affect the high speed turning in medium high speed corners, you need a really good rear end. And we've seen in the past that if Lewis doesn't have that he can lean on, if the car is a little bit tail happy, he's unhappy and he can't get the best out of it. You know, that's just his driving style. So I do think that there's just a general lack of performance. It will be tiny margins. You know, there's not going to be one thing that they can do with that car which suddenly becomes the silver bullet. There will be just a series of things that they've got to do, and they're in this position. You know, they are where they are. This is now when you see the true metal, and can they work their way out of it? Can they find more performance? Because if they can find more general performance, you know, both qualifying and the race, you're talking about 2-3 tenths. It will put them in a significantly stronger position. I know that's an obvious thing to say, but they are the margins that they're going to go and find now.
Is it getting harder for him? Is the floor upgrade that they brought a couple of races ago, is that actually more towards Charles's liking than his?
Because the margins are so tight and they're so small that I think it probably is too simplistic to make statements like that. I think it's more the case if Lewis has gone into this team, I think he had backed himself to be able to get to know a new package quickly. I think he had this image in his head that life was going to be a bit better than Mercedes, that the new generation of cars weren't against him. It was just the Mercedes version wasn't to his liking. And he's come to Ferrari, and I think it's just taken him more time than he had hoped to get settled in. And I honestly don't know whether or not, when they are making these changes, like you said, to the floor, whether or not that is making the difference for him now. But he has only been in the car for six races. He only had very limited testing in the car ahead of the season. I know it's the same for everybody. That's what drivers will always tell you. But the reality is, he just hasn't had that much time in the car. He's also much older, so I don't know whether or not it just takes him a little bit longer to get used to the car. but the very fact that he is so frustrated suggests that he is irritated by the fact that he isn't able to get on top of the car. And I thought it was actually a bit odd that in his post-race interviews, it was the first time he wasn't monosyllabic, actually. He talked much louder. So Lewis has this habit of when he's had a bad day, he stands away from the microphone, he talks very quietly, and he barely strings more than three or four words together. But after the race in Miami, which was not really much better than any other race that he's had, you know, bar that sprint in China, he was much more chatty, he was much more fiery, he was much more explicit in what the problems were. And so something clearly has changed, where maybe he feels like that race went better because he could show that he had the pace. And maybe something has changed in Miami. I think he's just irritated that he goes from one race to another, and it's just he doesn't know what Ferrari he's going to get.
I mean, he'd had a good day though, hadn't he? I mean, he was on the pace of Charles Leclerc, which he hadn't been at the previous races. And there was a lot of radio chat in Miami. It felt like confusion about what to do next. I mean, actually, Rob, maybe you're the guy to comment on this, given your experience both at Ferrari and with radio chat. And I'm thinking of Hockenheim 2010.
Okay, so Fernando is faster than you. Can you confirm you understood that message?
And guess what happened? There is a crucial move in the championship. Fernando Alonso goes past or through Felipe Massa, his Ferrari teammate, and into the lead in Hockenheim.
Okay, mate. Good lad. Just stick with him now. Sorry.
Oh, my God. Why are you bringing that up?
But it's
what's wrong
it's,
with you, Clarkson?
What did you make of the confusion on the Ferrari radio?
I think a lot has been made of it. I think there's two sides to this, right? First of all, it's really good clickbait, and I've been in that situation so many times where the driver is asking for something they feel it is entirely obvious, you know, what they're asking you to do. But there's quite a lot of cognitive function that needs to go into like making that decision. And if you think about it, if you listen to it, you know, it felt like it went on for a long time. I think as Fred said afterwards, it was a lap and a half that they were making the decision or something like that. Now, on the flip side, what you can argue is, well, why weren't they ready for this in the first place? They knew that we were going to have the two drivers on contra strategies. You know, that didn't happen outside of their control. In fact, the opposite. So they knew that this was happening. And, you know, you would then argue that, you know, for the future, and I'm sure that everyone within the team would agree with that, just be slightly better prepared so that when one driver does come up behind the other on a different strategy, definitely what you don't want to do is hold up and ruin the chance of that strategy working. That just doesn't make sense. So I think there's two sides of looking at it. I think that whenever a driver is, you know, and I've been in this situation personally many times, whenever the driver gets a little bit tetchy with the team or gets a little bit critical with the team, there's some great stories that come out of that, right? That kind of feeds us.
Felipe, baby, well, stay cool.
Well, that was me being tetchy with him.
I need a white visor, please come on. White visor. Otherwise, I cannot see anything.
Felipe, baby, stay cool. We're bringing you the white visor. Stay cool. We're in a good position. Okay?
Felipe, please, could you be quiet? Because we're trying to concentrate on other things. There's other terminologies and ways that you can phrase that. I also think as well, I agree with Lewis what Lewis said himself. I think he described it as he's still got fire in his belly or something like that. He's still motivated, right? He shouldn't be out there if he doesn't feel that level of motivation, if he's not prepared to say to the team, come on, do a better job, right? And Formula One is a great, great business for, you know, holding yourself and the team around you to account. Because if you don't, you're dead in the water. If you all kind of slapping each other in the back and saying, isn't it great? When actually you're down in like whatever they were at the time, like seventh and eighth position for Ferrari, it's not great, right? Wake up, guys. This isn't good enough. And let's get better at doing what we're supposed to be doing here, which is going out and winning Grand Prix. So I think, I don't know, I feel there was a lot made of it. You know, I can understand some of it, but maybe a little bit of a storm in a teacup as well.
So Imola, can Ferrari expect to be more competitive there?
This is probably not going to
make the Tifosi happy, but I see no reason why, unless they bring a different package. You know, we've had six races up to now. We pretty much know where the Ferrari is now. Like, why do we expect, you know, something significantly different because they're on home turf? I know that they are bringing updates. You know, all the team are bringing upgrades to a greater or lesser extent. You know, maybe they can make some small inroads, but I certainly wouldn't expect there to be any big change from the status quo that we've seen in those first races.
I wonder if Monaco is actually the litmus test for them, given how dominant Charles Leclerc was there last year. Do you think that Monaco will be the moment when they decide what the rest of the season looks like? If they're still off the pace in Monaco, then it's switch everything to 2026.
I think that they won't want to turn everything off too early, because I think history has showed in the past when you turn off too early because you just give up on a championship, just like BMW Sauber did, where they could have gone and won the title. You don't know what's going to happen in 26. You know, there's no evidence to suggest that even if they turn the taps off early, Ferrari are going to do a better job than anyone else. So I think all of the big teams will be reticent to turn off early doors. And I'm not sure if Monaco specifically is the one in which they'll decide either way. I think they've got a couple of things that they really need to do early doors, and that's just to try and make sure that Lewis is more comfortable in that car. So I think that has to become a priority, and whether or not that is to maybe put more resource into this year in the early stage of the campaign, just to give him that kind of impetus to kind of get what you paid for out of him and kind of put him on the level to maximize himself. And also on Charles's side as well, like, he's been so deflated recently. I think he feels like he's racing as good as he ever has done. I arguably think he was the dark horse last year in the job that he did. And I think he's driven really well this year. And obviously, he's not getting the results. So that's got to play into their decision-making to a point as well. But then again, we've seen Ferrari have always made decisions based on the reality. And it could be that they do decide very early that they're going to just switch everything off and turn it to next year. But correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they made a lot of changes, Ferrari, to this car, to the point where I think Fred said almost everything is new, not just in terms of new nuts and bolts, but just the new type of car, which always struck me as a bit odd, considering they were 40 points off the championship last year. Why you would want to go and chuck everything out the window for 1 year of regulation? But it might just be that they're just struggling to understand that car, and they just need the pure time. And it's not actually it's a bad machine. It's just that they haven't been able to understand it quickly. So I still think it's too early to do that for Ferrari, because frankly, P4 in the Constructors' Championship at the end of the year is not good enough.
Well, it is going to be good to see Lewis racing in Italy in red for the first time. And, you know, the hill opposite the start finish straight, I mean, you guys know this as well as I do, when it's full of people, is just, the atmosphere is stunning. But there's an added complication this year, isn't there? Would the Italian fans prefer a Ferrari victory or a Kimi Antonelli victory?
Ferrari victory.
Because, of course, Kimi...
Ferrari victory, 100%.
Really?
All day, every day. There is no question. There is absolutely no question. They would adore, and they would probably, you know, all die the next day happy if Kimi Antonelli was in a Ferrari and he won. But if they had to choose over an Italian driver or what is effectively the national team, all day, every day, they will choose Ferrari. No doubt.
Well, let's talk about Kimi Antonelli's team now. Let's talk about Mercedes. And George Russell's podium in Miami was his fourth of the season. He's now just 6 points behind third place Max Verstappen in the drivers' standings. Max is, of course, 32 behind championship leader Piastri. If we think Max is still in the title fight, does that mean George Russell is a title contender as well?
I mean, mathematically, yes, he is at the minute. In reality, I think even he knows that as the season goes on, it probably will fall out of his grasp. But I don't think that bothers him at the minute. I think I was really impressed by the performance of George in the race on Sunday. I think he had had a weekend where he himself said he hadn't felt comfortable in the car. I didn't feel confident in it. And obviously there would have been that itch that Kimi was having a great weekend, you know, qualifying the best he has in both the sprint and for the Grand Prix itself. Obviously got that sprint pole, the youngest ever to start in P1. And I think that George, for all the good that he's done this year, I think he's had three podiums already before that, before coming to Miami. He'd done such a great job, and yet I think there would be some needle that a lot of people are talking about Kimi Antonelli and the job that he's doing at Mercedes, and that was kind of overshadowing the job that George has done. He's out of contract at the end of the year. It's super important for him whether or not he stays at Mercedes or he goes somewhere else, depending on where Max Verstappen goes, for him to maybe be in the conversation. And I think that kind of performance that he delivered in Miami, he was talking about having stomach cramps in the last 15 laps of the race as well. Just the way that George has been a bit of a different person in the way that he's faced the media, the way that he's come across publicly this year, I think that was a big result. And I don't think he'll think he's in the championship fight, because we don't really know when various teams are going to turn off development over the course of this year. And to be fair, it feels like McLaren are kind of just away from it, and Max is so special that he's always going to have to be a consideration. But I think he's loving the way that he is in the mix, and the very fact that every time someone does an intro like yours, Tom, George is mentioned. I think he'll love that, because he's in the conversation, isn't he?
Rob, would you re-sign George Russell to Mercedes next year if you were Toto Wolff?
Yes. Yeah, I would. I would. I think George has done more than enough to show that he is now an accomplished and experienced Grand Prix driver. I was very interested over the weekend, both seeing him and then listening to, you know, some of his comments when Kimi was obviously doing very well in Miami. And it was just interesting to watch body language and also listen. You know, George was very, very unhappy that Kimi had, you know, got that sprint race pole, and then even outgunned him in the main qualifying as well. You know, normal order was restored in the race. But George was very unhappy, and I think that's good to see. You know, George wasn't sitting back and saying, oh, but it's Kimi Antonelli and we're expecting him to be, you know, the next Ayrton or the next Michael Schumacher or whatever. He was pretty unhappy, and you need that, you know, that fire and that motivation from a driver who needs to, you know, consistently earn their right to be in a top team. So if I was in Toto's shoes, yes, I would definitely re-sign him. He's earned the right to be re-signed. He keeps delivering consistently. But it all comes down to what Max wants to do, right? It all comes down to Max's availability.
Well, that was my next question. Would you re-sign George Russell if Max Verstappen is available?
Oh, that's a very, very tough question, because you've got a 4-times world champion who, he is a guy that he's one of those very, very special drivers, and there's very few of them who can drive over and above what the car can actually deliver. And he did that on Saturday in Miami, and he did that at the start of the race. So if I was in a position to make this decision, which is what you're actually asking me, Tom, would I want Max Verstappen in my car over anybody else on the grid right now? Yeah, 100% I would. No doubt.
You wouldn't take the James Vowles view that he would unsettle the team and he might not be the right fit?
No, I would take him. I would take the talent. I would take the talent and that grit and that determination. You know Max as well as I do. He cares about one thing, right, which is to go racing. The rest of it, the periphery nonsense that kind of, you know, hovers around Formula One, he has no interest in whatsoever. If you can put somebody that motivated and that focused in your team in any position, right, and that talented, whether it's in the engineering team, the commercial team, or in the cockpit, you want them. 100% you want them, because Formula One is all about putting that talent in, getting that talent in play, and then orchestrating it so that it can work together, and it will continue. Talent like Max Verstappen will continue to push the team to do 101% every single day. There's no days off. There's no slacking. There's no days where you can come in and do a little bit less. Every single person in that team has to give 101% every single day, and they have to do it 365 days a year. When you have motivational people like that in your team, it lifts you to the next level.
Lawrence, no one knows more about what's going on in Formula One than you. At what point in the season are we going to know more about the driver market? Is it the end of July? Is that when we're expecting either Max to jump ship or George to be re-signed by Mercedes?
I think it's going to be similar to previous years. So I think in the build up through July up until the summer break, I think that's when things will start to ramp up. I think we'll know for certain around September time where everything's going to go. I think it makes sense, because we've hinted at it already. Max essentially controls the market at the minute. I think it makes sense for Max to maybe hold on for a little bit longer. He can assess what he thinks of the Red Bull powertrain that he's going to have in the car for next year. He can have a better understanding of where this team is and if he's still got the confidence, as he has done since he's joined, that they can be in the fight next year. And it will give Toto a bit more time and Aston Martin a bit more time to try and have a conversation with Max's team to see whether or not he is going to move. I don't envisage it's going to be anytime soon, because frankly there is no rush for Max to do it. Everyone wants him, so he's got complete control of it. I think the frustration for George and everyone else is that they essentially have to wait, because I just don't see why Toto would sign George unless he knows for certain that it's not possible to get Max. And that's no disrespect to George, it's to Rob's point that Max is the greatest driver of his generation. He's going to be the greatest for the next couple of years to come. And Toto needs to get the team back up and running. You know, he needs to be a world champion sooner rather than later. So it makes sense that we're just all playing this waiting game, waiting for Max, even though ironically he's got a contract until the end of 2028 with Red Bull. He still controls the driver market because he could still leave.
This episode is sponsored by Vanta. When it comes to running a business, proving your security practices isn't just important, it's essential. Whether you're a startup founder navigating your first compliance audit or a security professional scaling your risk management, Vanta makes it easier and faster. Vanta is a trust management platform that automates compliance across over 35 security and privacy frameworks, including ISO 27001, SOC 2, the latest European frameworks like the EU AI Act and DORA, and instead of spending months on compliance, Vanta gets you audit ready in weeks, saving you up to 85% of the associated costs. Efficiency is key, and Vanta delivers. The platform automates up to 90% of the work, centralizing security processes and helping you complete security questionnaires up to 5 times faster using automation and AI. Plus, Vanta scales with your business, continuously monitoring compliance and streamlining risk management. And it's not just about saving time, it's about saving money too. An IDC white paper found that Vanta customers see $535,000 a year in benefits, with the platform paying for itself in just 3 months. That's why over 10,000 companies, including Flow Health, Synthesia, and Alica Bank, trust Vanta. And for a limited time, listeners get $1,000 off Vanta at vanta.com/nation. That's vanta.com/nation for $1,000 off.
2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at honda.com.
There's more to come from our Imola preview in a moment. But here are some other official F1 podcasts that you can listen to this week. My guest on F1 Beyond the Grid is 1978 world champion Mario Andretti. He reflects on the history of Formula One as the sport celebrates its 75th anniversary this week. And he tells us about the new Cadillac Formula One team joining the grid in 2026. That's available on your podcast app from Wednesday. And you can watch our chat on the official F1 YouTube channel. And the latest F1 Explains stars former Haas team principal Günther Steiner. That's out now. This time last year, Williams hadn't scored a single point after 6 races. They'd only just got their spare car finished. And what a difference a year makes, because now they're leading the midfield battle with 37 points in fifth place. And they head to Imola with real momentum after two double points finishes in the last two races. Rob, let's start with you. What do you make of Williams' progress over the last 12 months? On paper, at least, it looks extraordinary.
Yeah, they've definitely done a good job. There is no doubt about it. They feel like a team on the up. They feel like a team with momentum. I know there's a lot of talk about, you know, the focus is all on 26, but the reality of the matter is that they're actually performing in 25, right? And that didn't happen by accident. So whether or not the focus is on 26 or not, they put a lot of effort into, you know, making things work this year. And that's good to see. It's a team that has needed the financial injection that it's had. But I also think it's down to the fact that they've now got two very good drivers. You know, Alex Albon, there was lots of question marks from the sidelines about how good was Alex, because, you know, since he got demoted from the Red Bull team, how good were the drivers that he was ever put up against, and how good were the drivers that he was put up against in Williams, especially at the start of his journey. That's now been answered with Carlos, right? Alex is a very good driver. Alex has got his feet under the table. We know how good Carlos is. For me, Carlos is one of the best all-round drivers on the grid. He's definitely a guy in a top car, could win a world championship. So now they've got two very good drivers, and they've got two drivers that will push each other. We saw another radio conversation, which was perhaps overshadowed by Lewis's at the weekend. Carlos was pretty unhappy. That, to me, if I was in James Vowell's position, I would be happy with that. It shows that you've got two drivers who are ready to push the team. You know, Carlos was not happy with how things had gone on Sunday. And quite rightly, you know, he's taken a massive punt. You know, he'll be well remunerated, but he's taken a massive punt to come and work at Williams. So Williams need to step up in all areas to be able to accommodate a driver of his stature. He needs to help them to do that as well on the flip side. But it's good to see that, you know, there's a lot of motivation in the team, and they're not going to be happy with mediocre performances anymore.
I think that's what Williams wanted. They want a driver who's going to come in and tell them what is wrong. Probably not as publicly as it happened, but they will want him to feed back in terms of, you know, that they want his learnings from Ferrari. But I think Carlos is always pretty good at kind of controlling the narrative publicly. He supports the team. He is a team player. He understands there's no point in completely going after them in the media. But I think he was frustrated because, obviously, he'd qualified so well. I think P6 on the grid. He was the stronger of the two drivers, or it looked like it was. And the race just didn't pan out because of a number of errors that he felt was, you know, partly on his side, partly on the team side. So I think as this season goes on, and Williams continue to be a team that is punching at the sharp end of the midfield, is fighting for those kind of 8th, 9th, 10th positions, there's only going to be a certain amount of time that Carlos is going to be prepared to be beaten by Alex. And I think that was probably the first sign that we saw that, like, he's had his, like, honeymoon period, he's had his settling-in period, and now he needs to crack on, and he wants the team to be operating in a way that allows him to get the best out of him, and so that he gets the results that he feels he's capable of. So I think that might be a moment that we'll look back on as maybe the turning point, not to the point where they're going to fall out about it, but I think it's a point where Carlos is like, look, we've had our honeymoon period, let's crack on.
It's a fascinating intra-team battle, isn't it? What is it, 3-3 in qualifying? Albon 5-1 to Albon in the Grand Prix themselves. But can we move this conversation on to what happens next at Williams, right? That they've grabbed all the low-hanging fruit that comes with having money, which they've got from Dorrelton. How much harder is the next step? You know, Lawrence, you were talking about, you know, they're battling for positions in the lower half of the top 10 at the moment. How much harder is it to become a regular podium finisher?
Well, this is where we're going to see what James Vowles and the team and Dalton are really made of, frankly, because I think it is a little bit easier to get that low-hanging fruit. They turned everything off last year, early doors. I think March was when they started putting the focus on this year. So they've had a full year's worth of development, and I think that's they're seeing the kind of benefits from that. And I think that's always a smart move in the early phase of a year, because I think if you can pick up points early doors, you can essentially hang on towards the end of the year, whatever happens. I think this next step is going to be telling. They've got an in-loop simulator that they put a lot of money into that will be up and running. They put a lot of money into trying to get the facilities within Grove up to standard. It's going to take time. I think James has said that it's probably 2028 when you've got all those big infrastructures in place, you've got all of the new systems in place and the processes working until you see something. But I think we've seen, you know, Alpine kind of rose and they were P4, I think, for a couple of years, and they were on the brink to fight in what was then the top three. And we thought, oh, are they on the edge? And they've fallen back down. Aston Martin had that great year where they started strongly. And where have they been for the couple of years after? But I think all we can do is base it on what we've seen so far. And it seems like they've spent money wisely so far. It seems like James Vowles and Dalton have made good decisions so far. They've got a great driver lineup, as Rob mentioned. So they're doing everything right. I think now we just have to wait and see whether that is enough to make that step. I mean, McLaren have shown you can get back up to the sharp end. They're the one example all teams will be hanging on to, as it's possible. So, of course, they could do it. It's just that they're going to have to do it in a sense where McLaren are operating at such high level. So are Mercedes, so are Red Bull, so are Ferrari. One of those other teams are going to have to drop back for Williams to be in that mix.
I would describe it as like an 80-20 rule, right? Where, you know, there was a lot of low-hanging fruit. There was a lot of things that were wrong with Williams. And you're able to do the first 80% of them. You're able to build the first 80% of your capability with 20% of time, effort and money. The next part is very, very hard. You know, we use McLaren. It is a much maligned benchmark, I think, of like, you know, a turnaround. But that turnaround, you know, it's like all overnight successes. It was 5, 6, 7, 10 years in the making, right? There was a long time that team had spent building infrastructure, building capability in order to become, you know, a top team. And I think Lawrence made a good point here. Even then, it was still difficult for them to break into race wins, but they started to consistently win. And then it was winning a world championship. And you saw how difficult that was with McLaren. The team that has been as far behind as Williams, you've got to learn how to do it and get the confidence to do it consistently before you can move on. Otherwise, it becomes a bit of a flash in the pan, like the Alpine example, like the Aston Martin example that was used. You know, there's not the infrastructure, there's not that solid capability, there's not that ingrained know-how within the team of how to do, you know, how to move it on to the next level. But James is making all the right noises, right? He's not saying that, you know, next year we're putting all the effort into 26 and we're going to be winning races next year. He's saying that all the infrastructure and the capability building is going to be online 27, 28. You still need another 2 years after that before you're winning world championships. So this is an end of decade thing for Williams if they don't disrupt it from here until that point.
Fascinating, guys. Let's finally bring it on to Imola itself this weekend. McLaren going, I guess, as favourites. This is Red Bull's 400th Grand Prix, would you believe it? Max Verstappen going for his fourth consecutive win at the track. Just give us your thoughts on who is favourite. What does the podium look like this coming weekend?
I don't think we're going to see anything different, really, from the last couple of races. It feels like McLaren's, Lando and Oscar are having a near enough private battle up the sharp end, and then Max gets involved when he can outdrive the car and he can kind of make something out of nothing. I think we'll see George be in the mix when Red Bull are struggling. I think Ferraris are going to be a little bit off. I just don't see a pattern different to what we've seen so far this year. I think I don't expect any miracles overnight, even if teams like Ferrari are bringing some updates to Imola.
Do you think Lando Norris will put one over Oscar Piastri?
I think Lando, I know he was effectively a loser in that he lost out to Oscar on Sunday, but I think he gained so much that weekend. I feel like he put a lot of work into the simulator building up to that weekend, where he kind of learned a bit more about the intricacies of the car and why he maybe didn't have the confidence to really push it at the final limit of the car. So I think he actually made a lot of gains, both in quali, obviously got that sprint win, and was a good recovery drive, even with the fastest car on Sunday. So I think it was a real step forward for him. I think mentally, I think it helped his confidence. And I think he has got what it takes to beat Oscar, but he has to do it. He has to do it on one weekend throughout to really convince himself. That's the only person that really matters now. He's got to convince himself again, like he did last year and like he felt at the end of in Abu Dhabi, that he felt belief in himself. He's got to have that one strong weekend and he's got to knit it together. But I think he definitely made fewer mistakes across the weekend in Miami, which infinitely made his weekend better. So hopefully he can build on that into Imola.
Give us your 1-2-3.
So I'm going to go Lando, Oscar, Max.
My 1-2-3 would be Oscar, Max, Lando. And I think that Lando now has to take the opportunity of this race, the next race, to stamp some authority on the championship and over his teammate. Otherwise, it just gets more and more difficult from a psychological point of view. Because if you don't turn that into results, and I've been in this situation myself many times, where you're working, you know, twice as hard as the other guy, you think you've got everything under control, but you get to the next race and they show you which way is north again. That is a little bit difficult to take psychologically. And eventually, you know, your head goes down, or the driver's head goes down, and it's very difficult to get them back in that season. So, you know, they'll say all the right things and they'll make all the right noises, but they're just not in it anymore. And I think now, you know, over this next 2-3 races is the point where we're going to probably see how this battle is going to play out over the season. So I think it's really interesting to see how it's going to play out in Imola, for one.
I wonder if it's going to be Imola where it flares up. Norris has got a great record there. He's been on the podium for the last three visits to Imola. So he goes well. There aren't any really heavy stops there now. And that was an area of car performance where he's been struggling earlier this year. So for my top three, I'm going to go Norris, Piastri. And I think my P3 is George Russell again. I think the guy's been extraordinary recently. He just keeps banging in those performances. So two McLarens and a Mercedes. Now to a bit of controversy with our fantasy F1 team, F1 Nation Racing. We had our best weekend of the season in Miami with 247 points. That's almost unheard of for us. But it could have been even better without some miscommunication. Our deputy team principal, F1 TV's Laura Winter, suggested we spend big on McLaren and Mercedes as our constructors, and then someone like Oscar Piastri or George Russell as our main driver. Then, with very little budget remaining, to opt for four rookies or really cheap options. And that's exactly what we did. And to cover all the changes we were making, Laura also advised us to use the Limitless chip, which means you get an unlimited number of free transfers instead of the usual two. But, Lawrence, that chip also makes something else unlimited, doesn't it? And I think this is where we came unstuck.
Yes, so Tom, Laura's advice was 99.9% right. She just didn't give you the final 0.1% of the information you needed, which was critical. So the Limitless chip allows you to put any driver into your team, no matter what the budget. So you blow the budget wide open. So the sensible thing to do when you play the Limitless chip is to pick the two McLarens, to pick the two Mercedes, and to pick Max as your five drivers, and then to pick McLaren and Mercedes as your team. And because that miscommunication didn't come through and you guys didn't then swap out the rookie drivers or the cheaper drivers out to put the big drivers in, you kind of not only wasted that chip, but you obviously lost the opportunity to get a huge amount of points this weekend on a sprint weekend as well.
That's annoying and great intel. So look, everybody, don't make the same mistake we did if you haven't used your Limitless chip yet. And our team has now reset back to the following. We've got Oscar Piastri, Carlos Sainz, Pierre Gasly, Ollie Bearman and Isaac Hadjar with McLaren and Racing Bulls as the constructors. So let's bring it on to this weekend, Lawrence. What should we do for Imola?
So I think I back Laura's general view that you should try and have two strong teams. So if you can afford to have a McLaren and a Mercedes, and then you take the hit with drivers in positions 2, 3, 4, and 5 behind a big driver, I think that generally is the way to go. But I think the game is so much harder this year. So my advice would be that you swap Racing Bulls out because I think they've had their time in the sun. And I'd put Williams in because they've had two double points finishes. I think you want to try and capitalise on the fact that you get more points from the constructors than you do the drivers. And then I think you probably need to let Carlos Sainz go. I know that's going to hurt, but I think that in terms of the way that points are scored within this game, you need to pick a driver who is qualifying lower, but then makes more progress through the field. So gets the overtaking points, as well as will get the points for their ultimate finishing position. So if you can make it work, I would put Alex Albon in, because I think he is a stronger set for that. Or I would go for an Esteban Ocon, because he seems to have that kind of up and down season where he'll qualify low, but tends to have a high finish. So I think if you go double Haas and have Behrman and Ocon, that could be quite a strong team.
Right, you heard it here first. Lawrence, thank you. And who knows, if we see some promising results off the back of your advice, Laura's position as deputy team principal might be under threat. And remember, everyone, F1 Fantasy is free to play. Just go to the official F1 app or website to create your own team, and you can join our league to play against us and probably beat us and other listeners. Just search for F1 Nation World Championship 2025. Good luck for Imola. Well, guys, thank you both very, very much for your time. Rob, great to see you again. Lawrence, thank you to you as well.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, and thank you. Thanks both of you. Very interesting chat. Always a pleasure to have two such knowledgeable gentlemen to talk to.
Thanks very much to Lawrence and to Rob for joining us. And you can keep across all the action this weekend via F1.com and the official F1 app. And in selected countries, you can watch all the racing on F1 TV. Thanks very much for listening. We will, of course, be back on Monday from the Imola paddock with our review of the Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix. F1 Nation is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios.
. 2025 marks the 60th anniversary of the first Honda Formula One victory in the 1965 Mexico Grand Prix. More than half a century later, the drive and innovation that powers Honda racing still inspires everything Honda does, from F1 victories to the Civic Hybrid being named the 2025 North American Car of the Year. Honda Racing is leading the charge when it comes to innovation. And here's where it gets really cool. Every Honda-powered F1 car is packed with sensors, hundreds of them, all feeding live data straight back to the Honda racing team in Sakura, Japan. We're talking about real-time analysis that helps engineers squeeze out every ounce of performance on the track. And the amazing part? That same cutting-edge thinking is making its way into the cars we drive every day, thanks to the expertise of Honda racing engineers. Their work has led to advances like the hybrid technology now used in Honda's consumer vehicles. The 2025 Civic Sedan Hybrid is engineered for fun, from the racetrack to your driveway. Learn more about the Civic and the latest Honda innovations at Honda.com.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.